Fred Film Radio. I'm Matt Micucci from the 2016 FIAF Congress, and I'm very pleased to be joined by David Francis and Joss Marsh, who are the co-creators and co-curators of the Kent Museum of the Moving Image. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
So, first of all, if you could tell our listeners a little bit about the Kent Museum of the Moving Image.
Well, its name basically is a tribute to the Museum of the Moving Image that was on London's South Bank and was run by the British Film Institute. And we decided that it was very sad that that title had disappeared. So we called our own museum the Kent Museum of the Moving Image. It's a tiny replica. Well, it's not a replica. It's just... It is really a mom-and-pop operation. There's only two of us involved. We do everything ourselves. But what we want to do is to effectively engage the community, the local community, we hope some national community, even some international community, although after the recent vote, maybe international community is not something that Britain is going to get too much of. So we have big ideas. It's not a local museum. It's not concerned with Kent or what happened in Kent in the way of cinema. It's concerned with a very broad concept of what has happened in the history of the moving image from, say, time immemorial, or at least the date of the camera obscura, up to the present day. We believe that is a continuum and that the cinema is just one part of that. And there, before that, you could say it was the period of the magic lantern, before that, the period of the camera obscura, and the next period will be the digital era.
Right.
Well, you know, David's very modest, so I think one of the things he should have said was that he co-designed the Museum of the Moving Image with Leslie Hardcastle, and it was a museum which blew my mind, I have to say, and to which I took a large number of students and was very sad when it shut. But you have to move on. So he's also very modest in saying that it's just a mom-and-pop operation. Mom-and-pop can do a lot when they've got wonderful volunteers, and we are attracting wonderful volunteers. We've already had some fabulous interns. We are open for research already. We're open for interns already. We thoroughly enjoy doing that. I'm a teacher by instinct and heart, so please come. And the collection is very strong in research material. So I think one of our missions is to make research fun for people, to show them things that they wouldn't normally be shown in a museum, which gives them some of the inside track, the kind of thing that people who are true cineasts or historians of film are looking at, but which aren't generally shown to the general public. We can't see any reason why there should be a wall between experts and amateurs or general public. Everybody is able to appreciate all that material if it's presented in the right way. So we're trying to do some quite challenging exhibitions. One of the first, which we're tinkering with, and I'm not committing to this at the moment, and David's very worried about it, is an exhibition on the history of shadows. Because if you break down the history of cinema, you can break it down into component parts, and we had thought of having a permanent exhibition in about 35-40% of our display space that was devoted to movement, projection, size of the image, and I always forget the fourth one. Never mind. Yeah. For now,
dimension.
we're passing rapidly on, but you see what I mean. You can have all of that, but you can always have a summary. So we made a pretty late decision, which is why we can't quite get open before Christmas. We made a late decision that we would concentrate on one or other of those dimensions immediately and have a digital display that helped people accommodate the entire picture, so that then what you could do with shadows or with movement made a lot more sense in terms of the whole picture. But something like the history of shadows takes you through human imagination from the year dot. How did we respond to the fact that we had shadows as prehistoric people? Why did we create myths about shadows? We have such a history of imaginative engagement with this strange phenomena of light that's attached to our own bodies, and we create artworks like silhouettes, like photographs, which were sometimes called shadow pictures as well as sun pictures, and are literally shadows of the human body impressed on paper in their original formation. And then, of course, you move on to moving image, which is a world of shadows, in that wonderful expression of Maxim Gorky when he'd seen the first film show, Tonight I Have Been in the Land of Shadows.
Joss is also modest, of course, because she was a professor of Victorian studies and cinema, a very interesting combination, because she was very interested in all forms of performance in Victorian times and all sorts of, and particularly in the references to cinema or cinema-related subjects in literature and the other art forms. And so it's a wonderful combination in a way. I started as a film archivist from the film end. Joss started from the Victorian end, and we've come together in the middle, and I think it's wonderful that that's happened at a time when people are no longer talking about cinema and pre-cinema. They're talking about this continuous movement through different forms of the moving image and different types of performance. So that's her background in particular. And going back to what we were just talking about, why we finally decided in the end not to have permanent exhibition was also, we're in a town of only 30,000 people. It's got very good communication links, with London, which of course is a main area, and with Europe via the ferry. We're near 6 miles from Dover, and the train from Ashford and local airports. But if we had 40% all the time permanent exhibition, we fear that the people in our very community would not come back more. And certainly someone maybe in London who was trying to decide between all the different possibilities, they would say, well, we'll choose another. But we feel if every 3 months or so we can announce a new exhibition, that this will keep it fresh, keep our name in people's minds, and we don't want to be crowded out. We want to have people who are genuinely interested, but we don't want to be sitting behind a desk to an empty room. Otherwise, all the work we put into it wouldn't give us pleasure, and we'd feel that we'd made a mistake and we hadn't thought things out correctly.
Well, I think there's a happy medium. I mean, one of our ideals is to have people come up to us and say, I'd love to see a magic lantern in operation. Is there any chance of seeing that? And we'll say, well, possibly. Well, perhaps next Friday evening. And we'll slot that in. Or somebody coming and saying, I'm really interested in fan culture in the 1920s. Do you have material? And we'll say, yes, and it is available to the general public, and not only to researchers who are carrying cards of various varieties. And yes, you can come and have a look, and we'll be there with you and help you read through that material. I can't see why not. Otherwise, we're putting those walls back up again.
Well, the only difficulty one always has is making original material available and at the same time protecting it for the future. Now, my view about that is that if the material is not unique and you're aware that it exists elsewhere, that it is reasonable to actually let people handle the material, although there will be a level maybe of damage, because you know it isn't a unique item. I think the museum culture as a whole is tending to put everything behind glass cases and not allowing you to handle anything at all. And I think handling is part of the experience that you need to take away from a museum. It's actually, you want to feel something, you want to turn a handle, you want to see a projector actually working. Say a 9.5, Kevin Brown was talking about 9.5. It's a very nice, small, simple gauge. Maybe we will be able to have regular 9.5mm shows. So we want to strike a happy medium between making material actually available to people to look at the original, not in digital form, but of course at the same time we might have to say that's been looked at too much, we've got to put that one away a bit and say that maybe for a year or two we say, I'm sorry, we can't make that one available because too many people were looking for it and it's beginning to suffer.
But there are some creative interventions you can come up with, and we're lucky to have friends who are ingenious, and I've got a particularly ingenious uncle, so he's made a model zoetrope using a biscuit tin which can be replicated ad nauseam, so that children can come along and bash it, and they can see exactly how a zoetrope works and amuse themselves. And at the moment we're working on how to replicate thaumatropes, and I think we can do it using beer mats, which is a very, very, very cheap but extremely realistic way of doing it. It's very, very similar, and they're widely available, which is certainly an advantage, and I think I can get them printed at a good price if I wanted to start from scratch. And we're also having a go at stereoscopes, because it is an extraordinary experience to see Victorian 3D properly, in the way that the Victorians did. The world leaps into a three-dimensional, strange virtual view, and even when you see quite sophisticated people picking up Victorian implements like that, they are absolutely staggered at the visual sophistication of the Victorians.
But we often feel that dimension, which was the fourth one of the showcases in the permanent exhibition we originally envisaged, is an area that's often neglected, and it's not only the depth of the stereoscope, it's the width of the panorama, and it's things like kaleidoscopes and all sorts of optical toys which they aren't concentrated on movement, as pretty well everything is, but they also have this added dimension that gives you something else. And so we want, as far as possible, for people to be able to see the extra dimension in these particular toys or whatever you call them. And obviously you can't make everything move, but we will try as far as possible to have at least one example that people can actually play with themselves, so that they can get the same experience that Victorians or whoever invented the particular toy had when it first came out.
But lest we sound like the Victorianist is completely taking over the museum, this is not true. So we should tell you probably about the first exhibitions that we're planning.
Please do, yes.
Well, one of them is the art of... it's called... I think we came up with a new title, which was much better. Yes, it was Passport to Ealing, the Art of the Film Poster in the Era of Michael Balkan. Because Ealing posters were an amazing period in the history of poster art. Because this was a period when high-ranking, extraordinarily creative artists, not only commercial artists, though some of those are also brilliant, but artists were asked to create posters for Ealing. They were given very loose briefs, they were not over-directed, they were allowed to let their imaginations range, and they came up with some extraordinary posters which are works of art in their own right. So that's a very satisfying exhibition for us to curate, and we're really privileged to have as good a collection of Ealing posters as we have. But by having an exhibition like that, you have to bring together stories about the artists, the art of the poster itself, the history of the poster, Ealing Studios, which was, of course, one of the great flowerings of British cinema, and about the people involved in making Ealing films. And I'm glad to say that not only includes some wonderful figures in the history of film, like stars like Dirk Bogarde and even some foreign stars all came flocking to Ealing, but also my own godfather, who worked on as the youngest and most insignificant technician and draftsman on some of these films, and has left us some wonderful material. So it's personal for us as well.
And also it enables us to talk about the region, because although I said we're not a region that is concerned specifically with Kent, some of the Ealing films were actually made in Kent, and one of the artists, Edward Ardizzone, was actually born in the town where the museum is. So we're trying to keep all these links going, the links with the history of the cinema, the links with our community, the links with other cultural areas like art and music, etc. We're interested in a horizontal approach to the museum, in which the cinema element is at the centre, but that when you talk about it, you're not talking about it totally vertically. You're also linking it with other events, other relevant events that either happened at the same time or in some way connected with that experience. We want people to go away with a much more total experience, not just to say, just to think about the cinema or the pre-cinema element, but to think about how it existed within the community and within the life of the period.
I mean, to take an example, I mean, you saw Modern Times last night, I know, Matt, and that's a film which is also what you might call a piece of Depression art, which is came directly out of the poverty and misery of Depression-era America. And it belongs next to the great photographic records of the period and some of the great works of literature, like John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath and the wonderful film made of that by John Ford. Those things need to speak to each other, and if you're talking about Chaplin, you mustn't only talk about Chaplin, you must talk about Chaplin's context and the artworks that were part of the broad horizontally conceived cultural experience of the people at the time. Otherwise you don't understand Chaplin.
That's terrific. I really don't think there's anything we can add to that. Okay. Just practical information, I guess, for now. Where exactly is this museum going to be, and when is it going to be opening? Because I can't wait to visit it.
Well, it's in a small town called Deal, which is in Kent, in southeast England, 6 miles from the port of Dover, which is our the biggest route to the continent, very close to Ashford International Station. So, but also not that far from London, about 75 minutes by train.
It's in the middle of a Bermuda Triangle of car parks, very easy to park, close to the railroads, close to the buses.
No, very important.
But Deal is a very small town. I mean, I could give you the address, but it is 200 yards from the railway station, 200 yards from the centre of town, and 350 yards from the sea and the pier. Yeah. So it's not difficult to find. I don't think I have to actually give the address. As far as opening is concerned, we're thinking about sometime in February. We haven't got a specific date. That's February next year. We haven't got a specific date. We will have a website by that time.
We already have a Facebook page. You can, you know, watch this page and you'll find out what's happening. So that's Kent Museum of the Moving Image on Facebook.
Yes. So already you can. Then gradually there'll be more information. We'll try and post what's happening and etc. And when we're absolutely clear about what exhibitions we're doing and what other facilities we're offering, it'll all go up on our website, basically, and on Facebook. And we now pray is that we've got the energy to be able to get the whole thing together, because we've got so many ideas, by February next year.
Well, I hope so too. That was incredibly exciting, and I'm seriously looking forward to visiting this museum very soon.
Thank you
very much for joining us and talking with us about it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye. Thanks a lot, and this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.